Hello and welcome to Energy Unplugged by Aurora. This podcast features various experts from Aurora having in-depth conversations with key industry leaders, policymakers, and academics from all over the world. It explores the hottest topics across the energy market and gives a unique perspective on major energy issues.
Welcome to Energy Unplugged. I'm Hugo Batten, Managing Director of Aurora in APAC and California. Today's guest is Daisuke Sugimoto, co-founder at Renova, one of Japan's largest renewable developers. Daisuke has been with Renova since its inception over 20 years ago and has led the company's growth to over a gigawatt of capacity online today. They cover the full breadth of renewable technologies with investments in geothermal, biomass, solar, wind, and even hydro in the Philippines. So a really diverse portfolio. Daisuke, welcome to Energy Unplugged.
Hugo, thank you very much.
We're also joined today by Aurora's Rowan von Spreckelsen, a principal who leads Aurora's entry into new markets across APAC and is currently leading our work in Japan. Rowan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Hugo.
Let's maybe start with the history of Renova. It started back in 2000. How did the company evolve to what it is today? Where were the initial pockets of expertise? How did things kick off and progress, I suppose?
We actually started as an energy and environmental consulting company in the year 2000. And we evolved we started our first asset-based business in 2006 as a plastic recycling. And then we entered into the renewables market, which is the area that we focus on now, in 2012 when feed-in tariff was introduced in Japan. We started our product development several years before each of those years, but that's where we came from. And when we started the company, we had basically no expertise in any of these fields. Our CEO and myself are the co-founders of the company, but we were only 25, worked for a management consulting company for 2 years, and no money, no asset, no network of people or anything like that. So we just started with the problem-solving skills and a passion and aspiration to solve energy and environmental issues.
Did you see opportunities to diversify across different technologies, or was it more an opportunistic strategy just to jump on whatever project came up at the time?
Okay, well, in terms of renewables is concerned, we started as solar PV because, I mean, as anyone knows, I mean, probably is the easiest one to start with. But when we started working on these projects, I mean, we of course did realize the issues with the intermittency and variability of the output from these, you know, solar PV projects. And even in the early days, we thought that we would to solve these issues later on. And we decided that we would have to work on more stable renewable sources, such as biomass, geothermal, and so on. So we recently added hydro to our portfolio, but that's sort of the background behind what we are trying to expand our technology basis.
Obviously, as Renova has evolved, the Japanese market has evolved pretty profoundly around us. For our non-Japanese experts, Japan for a while now has been going through a liberalization, disaggregation of vertically integrated utilities, more competition, you know, a variety of topics like that. Can you give us a little bit of background on how the market has evolved and how Renova has responded to some of those challenges?
I mean, you know, in terms of renewables is concerned, of course, the introduction of feed-in tariff in 2012 in Japan had the largest impact for us so far, of course. And that allowed us, actually anyone, like any new companies to the market, allowed these companies to enter into the power generation market, which was dominated by the large power monopolies in Japan. So, I mean, it was basically the first chance for anyone other than the traditional power companies. And, you know, there have been many laws and regulation changes and so on related to renewables and power markets, decarbonizations and so on. And that sort of allowed us to start new services and modify our sort of businesses and so on. So yeah, a lot of the changes that happened in the policy making and so on has affected, you know, what we can do and what we have been doing.
It's interesting, right, that in a lot of these kind of liberalization processes, more volatile wholesale markets have been happening alongside gas markets experiencing very high degrees of volatility too over the last couple of years. Has this made it more challenging, or is the opportunity just much more obvious that we need to decarbonize and we need to decouple our electricity markets from volatile gas markets through greater penetration of renewables, batteries, whatever the clean technology might be?
I'm not too familiar with the other markets that much, so I might be wrong, but it probably is similar in like Europe and the US and in so on as well. But initially, when this, you know, global, you know, various things that has happened in the past couple of years occurred, there was not much changes or effects. But after a while, the Japanese companies started to realize that they need to, especially the off-takers, basically, the because there are a lot of manufacturers and so on here in Japan still, cost of energy is very critical for some of these, you know, manufacturing companies. So a lot of them in the beginning did not realize the impacts of these rise in the price of gas and oil and gas and electricity and so on, except for the ones that was, you know, directly using it. But the effects started to take place in the past year or so, and a lot of these companies are seeking to basically stabilize their electricity price, which is not happening anymore. It is giving us a lot of opportunities in terms of new sort of off-takers for us. Like, I mean, it used to be feed-in tariff, but we are now focusing more on corporate PPAs because, I mean, that's, you know, what companies want, and has created a sort of new opportunities for us and a new business for us.
I might jump in here. I mean, you mentioned about kind of feed-in tariffs and talked about some of the historical market reforms. Japan's still going through a fairly kind of seismic shift in the number of reforms at present. So we've got, we're moving from the feed-in tariffs towards the feed-in premiums. That's kind of kicked off already. Yes. We've got an introduction of a longer term, 20-year contract term capacity market. They're also in talking about introducing carbon pricing in the late 2020s. How is Renova thinking about that in terms of those future developments as well? Is it a matter of we adapted as we saw this come through in the past and we'll need to continue to adapt? Or are there kind of specific opportunities that seem to be coming out of these reforms?
Okay, well, thank you for that question. I mean, in general, we welcome these changes since, you know, changes basically provide us with the more opportunities for business and also flexibility in the business that we operate in and so on. So to give you a little bit of background history of our, I mean, as I mentioned in the beginning, we have been doing different things. And I mentioned that we started as a consulting company and then went on doing plus recycling and then started renewable business when feeding tariff was introduced in 2012. Now, there are a lot of smaller services and business that we used to do. And those came along because there has been some changes in the laws and regulations, market situations, customer demands, and so on. What I'm trying to say is we have been adapting to the market, the policies and customer demands and so on, all our throughout our history of the company. So, you know, something that we are used to and we enjoy. So, you know, a lot of these changes we see as opportunities for us developing. So we welcome these changes that's happening and ongoing. Some companies might not feel that way, but that's the way we see it.
How do you juggle that from a kind of risk management perspective as those changes come through? Because I know one of the key things with the transition from feed-in tariffs to feed-in premiums, for example, has put more risk on the developer and greater emphasis on future merchant prices as a result. Or has the kind of rise of corporate PPAs meant that it's essentially the name of the off-taker that's changed? It's government versus private, but it's still the business case is not that dissimilar.
Right. Yes. I mean, you know, I think in some senses and for some players, there's increased risk. And I mean, yeah, to some extent, yes. But I think as some of you might know, feed-in tariff in Japan originally was very, very lucrative. For example, the original feed-in tariff price for solar PV was about, at current rate, maybe 30 something cents per kilowatt hour, 40 Japanese yen. And it was just way too high. And those, I mean, we of course do have those projects as well, but those people or companies who were expecting, you know, the market to be that lucrative for a while. You know, recent change is just too drastic that it's very difficult for them to cope with. But as you pointed out, and as I mentioned, along with these change from a feed-in tariff to feed-in premium, there has been a quite an increase in demand for corporate PPAs. So we are shifting more to corporate PPA projects. Those go side by side in some cases. So we do both together, but that's what we're trying to do. And in terms of project development or new power generating project, renewable project development is concerned, there isn't too much opportunity for large scale or utility scale projects in Japan anymore because our land is limited. There are some opportunities for onshore wind, but it's getting increasingly limited. Offshore wind, yes, of course, there is quite a lot of opportunities and also some geothermal as well. But, you know, utility scale projects are being limited. So we are also trying to develop a bundle of small scale solar projects because these small pieces of land are still available all over Japan. So that's something that we're doing. And a lot of Japanese corporate PPA off-takers like these kind of projects as well. So that's sort of how we are adapting to the recent changes in the policy and also the changes in the sort of market availability of land and so on.
I think two things that I reflect on. One, policies that are unsustainably generous will, by their definition, not be sustained. And you should probably build some acknowledgement of that into your business plan. I think the second point is I do see globally the best developers are trying to build portfolios that are robust to policy tweaks. So they take a long-term view on where the market's going. They take a through-cycle approach to policy, and they will build diversified, robust portfolios that can make money under a number of different policy configurations. I'm thinking here of the likes of Neoen, Intersect, Iberdrola. You know, they're all doing this to various different degrees. So I think it's a common theme amongst agile, dynamic, renewable developers, and they'd echo exactly what you said there.
I'd echo both of you. It's definitely what we're seeing. And I think the last couple of solar auction rounds, to your point, that were undersubscribed because those 40 yen per kilowatt hour days are over, and the ceilings that are now in 9, 10 yen per kilowatt hour, somewhat mismatched with the rise that we've seen in CapEx over the last couple of years. So it's a more challenging proposition. It's something that I expect will play through and will come out the other side of it though. I mean, government is very focused on the 36 to 38% target of renewable generation in Japan. And the expectation is that solar will make up a large part of that around the land constraints, obviously, that you mentioned being a major concern. I'd like to kind of circle back on that a bit later. The other thing that will really influence this, I think, is the nuclear question and what the restart plan looks like. It's kind of post Fukushima, nuclear capacity went from almost 50 gigawatts down to almost nothing and is now still only around 15. Yeah. There are plans to double that, get back up to the kind of 30 gigawatt mark. But you've obviously got the kind of conflicting aspects of safety concerns and the political landscape may mean that may well take longer than expected. Keen to get your thoughts on this. Do you think that kind of creates an opportunity for firming technologies? And as a renewable developer, how does Renova manage that kind of uncertainty that we're seeing?
Okay. Yes. Well, I mean, definitely yes for the firming technology opportunities. And we believe that. So we are working on energy storage projects, developing energy storage projects in Japan, both standalone. So of course, grid connected standalone. Energy storage with renewables have been around for a little while in the areas with limited capacity or grid capacity, but energy storage is just picking up in the past year or so. We don't have a project up and operating yet, but we are working on expanding our energy storage pipeline quite a lot. In terms of firming and also how to use this kind of technology, we are still trying to figure out, you know, how to optimize it because, I mean, we haven't run it yet. And as you know, some of the market schemes and sort of shorter duration products in the electricity market are yet to be introduced in Japan and also the capacity market and so on. So, I mean, there is still a lot of uncertainties in terms of policy. But at the same time, you know, we don't really know how the market is going to work out, particularly with the impact from like global increasing oil and gas price, but at the same time, as you mentioned, with the nuclear and so on. So it is very difficult to, at least at this point, to say this is the right business model or, you know, how this is going to work out in Japan. We are actually, you know, talking to various consultants in Japan to sort of forecast, you know, what's going to happen. But, you know, we would like companies like Aurora to bring, you know, your expertise in that parts of the world where the markets are more advanced and also mature so that you could help us out on, you know, our efforts here in Japan as well. So that's kind of an expectation we have as well.
Yeah, and I very much lines up with what we're seeing in the market. I think particularly areas at the ends of the grid, like Kyushu and Hokkaido, the definitely hot battery markets over the last couple of years, that kind of focus has heated up a bit. And as you say, the new balancing markets that are being phased in replace of the old markets does mean that whole co-optimization of how you think about revenue stacking across different markets is the name of the game at the moment, and trying to get that early mover advantage. One of the expectations that we're seeing on that front is that if you couple those new balancing markets coming in, coupled with nuclear restart timings, if they are slightly late or there isn't as much battery build out or firming capacity as you might otherwise expect, then you potentially actually see scarcity pricing coming into the 1 year capacity markets for a few years, which again it kind of helps the business model for that first mover to pick up some of that volatility and that scarcity pricing. You touched on this earlier, just with regards to the grid. And I think both in the context of firming capacity, but even more so with deployment of solar and wind onshore, the pace and scale of the energy transition is accelerating in nearly every geography that Aurora works in globally. And Japan is looking to procure 10 gigawatts of capacity over the next couple of years as part of their new 20-year capacity market, which is not a small ask. But we're already, as you say, we're already getting to the point where a lot of the best solar sites are gone. The higher scale, larger scale grid connection sites are used up, and the grid is becoming a bottleneck. That's very much something that a lot of markets are seeing, a lot of governments are grappling with at the moment. You've kind of said, look, this is what we're seeing already. So it is a fair reflection. But what's your expectation? Is it that we will just continue to see CapEx costs increase because we've got higher connection costs over the next couple of years? Does government have a role to play in here with fast-tracking grid investment to mean that actually the target can be realized without the private sector needing to build a lot of transmission itself, which obviously typically doesn't sit as a private ownership. It sits in kind of regulated companies.
Okay. Well, I guess, as you pointed out, the grid connection is becoming more and more difficult. The cost of grid connection that we need to pay to the power company is increasing, along with the time that's required for them to do the actual construction work and the enhancement of the equipment and so on. So sometimes, you know, we've been told that it's going to take 5 years to connect to the grid and even longer sometimes. And it's getting very difficult. I think there are two parts to your question. And one is, you know, how each project, like the ones that we develop, actually, you know, connects to the grid. In countries like us, Japan, where the country is fairly long and with separate islands, and as you know, we have very weird transmission system of 60 hertz and 50 hertz in different parts of the country. So I don't know how you say it in English, but like the core transmission line or the main transmission line needs to be enhanced so that regions like Hokkaido in the north and Kyushu in the south, where electricity is generated in those areas, to be transmitted to areas like Tokyo and Osaka, where there's a great deal of demand. So in terms of the first one, what we as a project developer, a renewable player, is trying to do is work with the power companies to reduce the cost and also the time required to connect to the grid by, you know, laying out down our own line to the substation where, you know, other people ask the power company to do it and so on. And also trying to optimize the sizing and also the design of the enhancement and so on. So that's one thing we're trying to do. But in terms of the large transmission line upgrades, we cannot do it. So it's very in active discussions at the Japanese government level.
I think the other aspect of it as well, as individual projects are trying to come on, is that, and for those listeners that aren't super focused on the Japanese market. Japan's got a unique connection rules that you can be classified as non-firm or firm, with the classification that if you are a non-firm connection, you're allowed to connect to grid even if there's no spare network there. But you take the risk that the grid operator will curtail you first to whatever level they need to help manage congestion on that. So that potentially could be really material curtailment. How are Renova, how are investors thinking about the risk on that? Is there sufficient data and modeling that you can get comfortable with taking bets on the future grid, taking a non-firm connection, or is it very much kind of firm or nothing as far as connection goes and getting these projects underway?
Actually, this is a very good and difficult question to answer, but at least the way we see it now, I mean, yes, there's uncertainty, but at the same time, it can't be sort of forecasted based on the past data and so on. So we are working with, of course, with the third party or industry advisors on double checking, you know, the way we're seeing is appropriate or not. And either way, if we were to try to do a project and get it financed, we need a third party report by, you know, independent consultants anyway. So, I mean, we're doing that. Now, I think a lot of these Japanese consulting companies have access to quite a lot of data, but not necessarily have proficiency or, you know, analyzing these data and so on. And that is also the area that we are hoping, you know, companies like Aurora to bring to the market, you know, with these, all these local data available or through these consulting companies and so on, and combining your expertise in your in like more vast and mature market like Europe and Australia, US and so on.
And these grid access questions are a persistent theme across markets. I've spent the last 3 months in California where deliverability, which in some ways is their version of this issue, is creating enormous problems for renewable developers, and lead times to connections are really blowing out. I don't think any market has nailed this. Just to open this up a little bit and maybe get into the realm of geopolitics, energy security has been at the heart of Japanese domestic and foreign policy for decades now. Japan has a set of natural constraints, limited land space, no gas, those types of things. What lessons do you think Japanese policymakers and senior executives are taking from the current crises in Europe and Australia in particular? Is it to double down on things like hydrogen and ammonia to insulate ourselves from volatile commodity markets? Or, you know, is it more about long-term security of supply? Or are they just thinking about this problem in different ways over different time periods? What do you think are their key takeaways from observing these trends overseas?
Well, I mean, as you know well, probably, and you know, some of the audiences know, many Japanese energy-related policies have been based on like European policies and some US policies and so on. So unfortunately, we have been lagging on a lot of these things up until now. And, you know, something like feed-in tariffs, the electricity market, especially like, you know, balancing service and things like ancillary services and things like that, carbon pricing and cap and trade. And so, I mean, all these we import from like Europe and the US and it's all. Now, in terms of energy security, I think the situation is similar as in Europe, or at least some of the countries in Europe, in a sense that we explicitly depend on importing of, you know, these oil and gas and so on. But at the same time, we probably have been a little unique because of the our geographical location, and with the probably even more challenges, and also, you know, it being an island country, it probably posed us more problems in the past. Now, yes, as you pointed out, the Japanese government, and we are looking into hydrogen and ammonia as, you know, future for not necessarily replacing immediately, but like, you know, coals and oil and gas and so on that have been importing quite a lot. So I guess we are on a similar path, but the way we're doing things might be a little different because, yeah, I mean, we don't have pipelines. We just have to ship all these and so on. So
you talked briefly there on hydrogen, Hugo, in the question. We'd probably be remiss to not talk about hydrogen in the kind of context of Japan energy policy here. Daisuke, what's your take here? All hype or central need, particularly for an island nation like Japan that needs to import a lot of fuel? Like, do you think there'll be all the thermal generation will retrofit turbines to start co-firing coal and gas with hydrogen or ammonia? Does that play a competing role to biomass, for example, long term? What's your take on the hydrogen question?
Okay. I don't know about all, but I mean, I think a lot of Japanese coal-fired power plants probably will be retrofitted to coal-fired and, you know, gas-fired turbines to use hydrogen and so on. The question about, you know, whether it's a hype or not, I mean, I think at least Japanese government is very serious about hydrogen and ammonia. As some of you might know, Japanese government has a target of importing about 3 million tons of green ammonia by 2030 and 30 million tons by 2050. So pretty hefty amount. Just target, but some of the large Japanese coal-fired power players are sort of already running bids for green ammonia, not just green, but blue and green ammonia in fairly large volumes to start importing and starting somewhere around 2026 and 27 and so on. So the government is serious, you know, the target's there, and the actual private companies are working on it already. So I think it's going to be quite real in Japan, and we believe so, and that we try to work on these projects as well. But unfortunately, the cost of electricity here in Japan, renewable electricity here in Japan, not that low. So we are basically looking outside of Japan to explore this kind of opportunity so that we can produce green ammonia or green hydrogen at a very low cost, even including the freight from that country to Japan.
And certainly the Australian government's done a lot of work on modeling and investment in the hope that it will export hydrogen or ammonia in vast quantities to the Japanese market. A final question from us that we always ask: who do you read or listen to in the energy space that is always good, thought-provoking, and relevant to your work in the private sector? Is it anyone that springs to mind, Japanese or otherwise?
I don't follow like any particular person or sites or sources and so on. So what I usually look at is, you know, normal sources like IEA, Arena, you know, Bloomberg, Reuters, you know, Financial Times, Recharge, you know, these sources like anyone probably is following. And now we have just, you know, subscribed Aurora. So I'm very much looking forward to receiving, you know, a lot of information from that. So, I mean, that might be my answer maybe half a year from now.
Well, that, I stress, was very much unsolicited, but the perfect answer to finish up on. Thank you so much for your time today. We've covered an enormous amount. I know you're one of the busiest people in the Japanese energy space, and we're incredibly appreciative of your time and thoughts. All the best, and thanks again.
Thank you very much for your time and this opportunity.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Daisuke Sugimoto, co-founder of Renova, talking to Hugo Batten, Aurora's managing director of APAC and California, and Rowan von Spreckelsen, a principal who leads Aurora's entry into new markets across APAC and is currently leading Aurora's work in Japan. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to subscribe on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.